colder. My eyes go thin as I get older. Piece in pieces, bloody and bruised. I feel so helpless and confused. 'Cause I hear screaming on the left, yelling on the right. I'm sitting in the middle trying to live my life.
Hello everyone, this is Evelyn Pringle. Welcome to Focus on the Facts. In starting my show, I always like to mention the methods of genocide taking place in the U.S. in multiple ways. First and foremost is geoengineering. Millions of people are finally realizing the implications and devastating effect of geoengineering. And an enormous amount of information is available on these programs and how they work in conjunction with each other in boosting awareness. The multi-level assaults on our health by spraying toxic chemicals and metals such as aluminum just makes us weak and powerless, and that's exactly one of its goals. Epidemics of all kinds of diseases and health problems are exploding, such as Alzheimer's and dementia, while this information is ignored or falsified in the corporate government-run mainstream media. But factual information on the reality of this health crisis is available on the Internet for anyone willing to do proper research. Those who are awake don't have to look further than their immediate vicinity to realize there is something seriously wrong on the matter of health. The next form of genocide is by the forced vaccinations of children and people in the military with vaccines that include mercury, aluminum, formaldehyde, and tissue from aborted babies that are causing all kinds of lifelong injuries of brain damage and body organs to people, including autism in children and Alzheimer's and dementia in the elderly from flu vaccines. Another method of genocide is the prescribing of mind and body damaging drugs to people of all ages and the medical care the U.S. is providing that causes diseases but does not cure any. And finally, we have the genocide by the toxic and poisonous foods sold in grocery stores to families all over the U.S. and then the poisoning of drinking water for people all over the U.S. And the poisoning of drinking water is getting worse. Flint, of course, everybody's heard of, but there are studies out now that says that many states have just as bad a water as Flint has, and there was just a report out, I think it was today, that there's radiation in the water by New York City from a power plant leaking up there. So, I mean, drinking water is really poisonous to many people in the U.S. Today, my guest is Martha Rosenberg. She's one of the most knowledgeable and up-to-date authors and journalists on Big Pharma. We're going to discuss this latest study out on antidepressants. It was in the British Medical Journal, and what it found was children on antidepressants are at double the risk of aggression and suicide that take SSRI antidepressants. But the drug companies hid this in their clinical trials and studies, and that this study looked at all the clinical trials and the reports from the drug companies, and that's where they came to this, that doubles the risk of aggression and suicide of children on antidepressants. So, Martha, are you here?
Yes, I am, Evelyn, and nice to talk to you today.
Yes, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Have you had a chance to look over this study?
Well, I certainly have, and, you know, you have to really hand it to British Medical Journal because they're also the ones that last fall covered the Paxil reanalysis, which was also,
right.
You know, so it's like they're, thank goodness for them, you know, but I did read this, and they looked at 70 studies, and they found miscoding of these behaviors, the suicidal tendencies and the aggression, and the people miscoded it so that they could make their profits while the drugs were on patent. And you know, what I feel Big Pharma does, and I have covered them for more than 10 years, is they'll readily admit all these problems with their pills after they make their money.
Right, right, because we're looking at this. SSRIs came out, the first one, Prozac, was in 1987. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The world's looking at this. This is how many years later. And we're just finally getting this documented.
And of course, you, as a leading pharma reporter and others, have reported this for years. And, you know, it's sort of a victory in a sense that it's in the medical journals, but it's also really a sad non-victory because all these people took the drugs, continue to take the drugs, can't get off the drugs, and pharma made its money and lied and covered up. So it's, you know, it's a bittersweet moment.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I guess you're more optimistic than I am, you know. I'm so disappointed that it took this long, and you have to remember that the drug companies, when they have studies done and everything, they fund them and everything, but it takes researchers that aren't getting paid anything, probably, to do this kind of a study, and the work and the years that go into it, you know, to finally reach this. But can you imagine how, and it was suicide and aggression. So all
right.
These stories, like you said, I've been covering these since 2003, and I've been reporting on this. And
right,
you know,
right.
The FDA is complicit because they knew all this, you know, and they let those drugs get out there and get them to kids and push, you know, to get them to kids. I think it took us till 2004 to ever get that suicide warning for kids on there. And
even
came
on there, yes.
Seven. And so all these, you know, horrific murders and stuff and school shootings and everything of these kids are on drugs, pharma knew it the whole time. And let this go on, you know. And so now, like I said, you're more optimistic than me. I'm just so frustrated over this because, right, I posted 75% of the articles I wrote on this. And and all of them, going all the way back, show that we knew this was happening. And they just kept prescribing these to kids and let it happen. And all of the people that, you know, like the shooters in schools or other places, you know, that they did this and it was because of the drug. These CEOs of these companies ought to be in prison.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
All the suicides
they've caused. They're accessories to murder. I mean, it's no coincidence that all these, you know, teenagers, adolescents, these young people began going into malls or schools and killing everyone exactly when these drugs became popular. It's no coincidence. I think
absolutely
that they've looked at none of these shooters, these big mass shooters, were drug free. They were either on the drug or they were going off the drug, and that would include Virginia Tech. Okay, that includes Northern Illinois University, which is close to where I live. That certainly
right.
includes Aurora and the Tucson. I mean,
all the way
all
back
of these,
to Columbine.
Yeah,
all the way back to Columbine.
Right, exactly. Now I forget what that
all
was
the way
again.
Back to Columbine.
Yeah, and
they
FDA is absolutely complicit. I mean, even some might say, well, we didn't know, or, you know, what they say so often, Evelyn, that just makes me sick, is
me too.
That we don't know in which cases it might save the lives of the kids. Well, you know what? First of all, before these SRIs, there were other antidepressants that could, if somebody was going to kill themselves out of depression, they could be used that didn't make them into these violent people. So it's not like these were the only drugs, you know. But when
right.
they say, well,
right.
you know, the big argument against the warning in 2004 was, well, we don't want to scare away doctors and patients. Well, yes, we do, and yes, we should.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And, you know, you and I have been reporting every time there's a study or something comes out, you know, somebody finds that the suicide rates are up, and they always find that big pharma hid them. And we report on that, you know, and I was talking about that yesterday, that I said, I remember back when it came out, I think Senator Grassley discovered in a study came out that people, I think, was on Paxil. He was going after GlaxoSmithKline. That
mm-hmm.
they hid, that they knew that kids on Paxil were 8 more times more likely to commit suicide than someone on a placebo. So I said then, well, now, if a parent went to a doctor and the doctor was honest with them and said, well, I have to tell you, I'll try this antidepressant, it might work, but I need to tell you that your child is going to be 8 more times likely to commit suicide than
mm-hmm.
if they were on a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
What doctor would have given their kids that drug? None. But now we're up to it, increased to 50%. What parent would have ever given their child a drug if it was going to increase their chances of committing suicide or getting aggression 50%? this is insane.
No, you're absolutely right. It's really crime before our very eyes, and I think we've also talked about how big the SSRIs are in the military, and you have those high suicide rates there, and the big pharma and the medical establishment always pretend that they're baffled. There's no baffling to it. It's very apparent, you know, that this was the first war, the Iraq and Afghanistan, that had SSRIs, and that
Correct.
Was the reason, and that is the reason. And a lot of these poor suicides never even deployed. Okay, so you can't say it was combat, you know?
Right. You know, years ago, people couldn't get the military if they had a mental illness. Now, almost all the military, while they're in action, are on these drugs. So think of that, the aggression and things when they're on these drugs over there in these horrible conditions. You know,
well,
what that's
and you know,
like.
You mentioned something else, Evelyn, that I hope we can talk about a little, which is this whole idea of mental illness as being redefined. Okay, it used to be, you know, maybe you're growing up, you have moods. You're an adolescent, you're this, you're that, maybe you don't like your job or you don't like your parents. They didn't call it a mental illness or depression. They called it growing up. They called it life, you know?
Exactly.
And now everybody says, oh, I've got a mental illness. No, you don't. And the reason there's several reasons this infuriates me. One of them, of course, is that, you know, the harm that the drugs do to people, not just making them suicidal, but ruining their health and making them big and fat and all these other things. But secondly, all these people on SSRIs, which is estimated at a quarter of the population, this is just what you said at the start of the show, they're all urinating into the water supply, and the SSRIs are in the water supply. And,
right.
and I know that sounds extreme to say it, but there are studies where the fish are on Prozac. I mean, it's true.
Yes, and they are changing their bodies. They're sterilizing fish. They're changing. They affect all these different organs in the fish. And so, of course,
right. I mean, these drugs in the water supply, most municipal water systems, possibly all of them, were not designed to filter out drugs because 100 years ago, you didn't have the whole world on drugs. You know, it wasn't, you know.
Right.
And so they're going right through. And that's why they now have this big thing about recycle your prescription drugs, don't put them down the toilet, because they know darn well that the waterways are swimming with drugs. And so, you know, that's another reason why it does affect. It raises our tax dollars and our health insurance when all these people take drugs they shouldn't even be taking. It puts the water at risk, and it also ruins legitimate outrage. I mean, let's say the 1% is running the world. There aren't any jobs, even if you have degrees. And, you know, all these issues going on in this country. And if you're on that so-called happy pills, you don't care. That
yeah.
is one activist that's no longer an activist because he's on happy pills.
Right. Exactly. And these people with all these psych drugs get so they don't feel anything. They don't have empathy. They don't have, you know, they're losing touch with reality, really, in communicating with other people and stuff. They don't understand other people because these drugs affect the part of the brain that control the emotions, and they're losing empathy, so they can't even relate to people with problems. Much less their own.
No, you're absolutely right. It's you know, on the surface it may look like it helps, but it doesn't help them because, you know, there's a lot. I always say this. There is such a thing as depression, but a lot of it is not the same thing as unhappiness. And many people
right.
are unhappy for real reasons like bad jobs, no jobs, family problems, money problems. And this is not a reason. You know, this is reason to roll up your sleeves and become an activist and say, wait a minute, what are lawmakers doing? Who are they serving? You know, why are they serving Big Pharma and Big Chem and Wall Street and not me? You know, normal. A lot of our unhappiness is the government and our lack of democracy. It's not a brain imbalance. You know,
no, it's situational. I mean, especially now, like all the things you're mentioning, what's gone wrong with this country? That,
mm-hmm.
You know, right? You know, people out of work. That always causes problems in relationships and things. You know, and then too, when they're on these drugs, those drugs affect you emotionally. As far as, you know, like they lower your libido, for instance, mm-hmm. and things like this with couples, that doctors didn't tell you this, so all of a sudden, you just don't want to be with your partner or with your husband or wife, mm-hmm. and you don't have an explanation for it. But it came from these drugs, but they didn't warn you about this. I used to say, when they put you on these drugs for life, if a doctor would have told you, hey, I got to give you this choice, so I'll put you on these, but chances are you'll never really enjoy a sexual relationship with your husband or wife or anything, I don't think they would have went for it. That's
I don't know. They absolutely wouldn't if they gave you true informed consent. The price, the fatness, you know, you have so many overweight people, and you know, that is very correlated with all the people on these drugs, because, like you say, ruins your sexual life, makes you fat, makes you no empathy, not caring. How is this an improvement on anything? It makes pharma rich, but it's, you know, it's just a shock. And
right,
another
you know,
thing that they've done, you know, when they've redefined mental illness, and they're doing this, you know, you and I have talked about NAMI and the pharma front groups, and they're in the high schools, they're on the colleges, they're telling anybody who's got trouble in a class or PMS that they have mental illness, and they're really selling the young people on how cool it is to be mentally ill, which is to say to take their drugs. And a part of the redefinition of mental illness is they now call depression a lifelong illness, and it was never called that 30 years ago, okay?
Right,
it was
right.
A self-limiting, it was an unpleasant experience, but it wasn't a lifelong condition until pharma came along and decided they could capitalize on it. And so you have
right.
people who are either on these drugs because they're afraid of their own sadness, or more likely they're on the drug because they can't get off because of the withdrawal.
Right, right. They are so addicting. And the pharmaceutical companies never told people that either. No, they are.
You're right.
I mean,
you're right. They didn't tell them. They didn't say, look, it's easy to pop this pill, but it's going to take weeks or months to ever get off it. And we know now that it's so difficult that people just say, to heck with it. I'm not going to even try.
Well, right.
It all makes
you know,
money for these. You know, it's just amazing, like you say, all the informed consent that wasn't given when these drugs were given out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there should have been a whole list of things they should have went down with and said, you know, this you might get this. And they aren't rare. These side effects aren't rare. You know, they happen to most of the patients. But this withdrawal one, yeah, is absolutely terrible. I think Glasgow was the only antidepressant maker that got sued for three things, and that was suicide, withdrawal, and birth defects. Now, they never told you about the birth defects, and they fought that for years. And look at how many they created. That one major case lawsuit thing alone had like over 600 cases in one big suit in the U.S., and that was just over in Pennsylvania. But there was all kinds more, you know. But we report on this stuff, and nothing happens. Nothing happens. I mean, all of these people that have been killed by suicide and that are hooked on these drugs for life and can't get off them, and then you think about that, think of the expense of them, how they jacked up the prices on everything so high that people have to pay these charges, and then
mm-hmm,
also
mm-hmm.
us taxpayers get milked, you know, bankrupting the health systems. You know, it's not the people that are disabled or anything that are on them, the money that goes to them. No, it's these costs for doctors and psychiatrists and drugs that have bankrupted these health systems.
And you know,
and so,
you mentioned, you bring up an interesting point, too, which is when birth defects are being caused by a mosquito, suddenly there's $1 million to, you know, because it's not big pharma causing it. But this tax
right.
of birth defects was very underreported. I personally did not even hear about it until pretty recently. I mean, it wasn't out there when the pill itself was selling, you know, as a blockbuster.
Well, you know, I was reporting on that probably as far back as 2006, probably 2005.
On the birth defects?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because you know, my daughter was on SSRIs and she got pregnant. And I learned this, and I came up here, you know, and told her to have her shrink take her off them, and the shrink wouldn't recognize us, you know. And then it was funny, a roommate I had, down the line, he sees this little article in the like a last page in the newspaper in Green Bay about
mm-hmm.
SSRIs and birth defects, a little article that nobody probably noticed, you know, but they knew it, you know. But, yeah, all these side effects were known. And, you know, I wanted to touch on something you said before, too, about the water. when you said mm-hmm. about all these drugs, you know, in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are so many in the water that they can say, well, don't dump your drugs down the toilet. That'll help. The water going through everybody. And when we urinate and stuff, puts it in the water. So
mm-hmm.
they did a study in Minnesota of all the rivers, all the streams, all the lakes. They found as many as 43 drugs in the water in Minnesota. And two of them were in almost every sample they took. One for diabetes, and I'll forget, I think the other one was a blood pressure drug. Was
mm-hmm.
in every
mm-hmm.
sample they took, Martha. So think of us, having all those drugs put in us all the time, mixed up together. Those of us that wouldn't touch them.
You know, the water supply is also very underreported. I know the Associated Press reported on it a few years ago, and then I recently read some things about the fish behavior and the samples.
Oh, yes.
But it is sort of like the biggest thing there is, because it's the combination of everyone's overuse of drugs, and it affects those, even those who won't take them themselves, like you and me, we're still affected. You know, and
right.
You talk about genocide, but when you think of getting a population very compliant and very passive, you know, that's kind of, you drug them, you know, you drug them up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean,
right. And then the mind control was selling all these drugs on TV and selling the poison food on TV, getting all people all addicted to these poison foods that they sell in the grocery market, and then all the drugs.
Well,
you know,
it is an addiction, you know, for sure. I mean, when you look at our crime statistics and when you look at these mass shootings that happen, you know, which probably they're on the drugs, you don't see that in other countries that aren't so run by pharma. I mean, we're completely dominated by big pharma because of our direct-to-consumer advertising. And, you know, you can see that, you know, how so many quote-unquote diseases were made popular because of the ads, you know, like we talked about the mental illness, but also, you know, the statins and the cholesterol. Well, how about you just eat normal? You don't need those drugs, you know? Just eat like a normal person.
It's come out now that they know those drugs don't help people. They make the diseases worse. And they're still selling them hand over fist to everybody. People are still taking them. You know, I was on a blood pressure medication, and I went off it after learning this. And, of course, I shared with you last time we talked that I have changed my whole eating, everything around in my life to get rid of these poisons, get them out
That's
of my life.
Wonderful.
And I feel 100% better, you know.
Uh-huh.
But anyhow, day before yesterday, that doctor's office called me and told me that I was scheduled to come in March or something for these. I just went off. I said, I'm never coming to your office again. You're giving us them pills of poison. I'm never coming to you again. And I slammed the phone in her ear. I mean, that's all I can think to say. And I know that some of the medical professionals don't know they're doing this, but a lot of them do. A lot of them do, you know. And
well, they're trying to, the problem, Evelyn, is they try to make us look like fringe nuts. And I get so angry at that. When you say, you know, this pill is popular, it's being sold, and it does X, Y, and Z, there's three things they immediately want to assume about you as a reporter or even as the activist. First, they're going to assume that you personally were harmed and you have some vendetta against Big Pharma. Secondly, they're going to assume you're working for trial lawyers. And then thirdly, they're going to assume that you're a Scientologist. You know, they can't just figure that maybe you're right and this is actually the news. This is what's going on. And that's why something like, and on a more positive note, why the BMJ article is so great, because it is mainstream. It is mainstream medicine. It's not, you know, Meditation Today Journal. You know, it's because they try to marginalize anybody who questions these things. There's no money
right.
in, you know, the money is in ignoring this stuff and prescribing this stuff. And what I get so angry at is how they'll always admit it later. I mean, now they're admitting, oh, well, yeah, the statins do, I forget what it is. They harm your memory and they do some other things, okay? I think maybe your liver or something. Well, now they're saying it because they have a new pill that they're selling against, you know?
Right, right. Well, you know, I think they had a hard time coming at me, because when I came out writing about this stuff, I wasn't involved with anything. In fact, at first I was writing articles for free. I was working at Dayton Daily News, and I started doing this at night on my free time and weekends. And
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and it started out over Teen Screen. That thing that trying to get into schools to screen every single child for mental illness, you know. Well, I'm a former AODA counselor, and I did a lot of family counseling. So, I mean, I know what problems cause people to get depressed or cause people to, you know, feel upset and all this stuff. And we worked through those issues. So when I seen this, that they were going to do this, put this in schools, and try to label every kid mentally ill so they could drug them, I knew that's what it was about right off the bat. You know, I just took off after it because I was so angry because I worked with troubled children and families and stuff, and I knew what causes these problems and that you work through with therapy. You know, so easy.
Right.
I never, in 12, 13 years of AODA counselor, I never sent one person to the doctor to get antidepressants. Not one.
And you were an early voice,
you know,
an early voice
an
against
alcoholic.
The teen screen. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But coming
and,
in as an alcoholic, believe me, you got all the problems that they would label mentally ill. But they're not. You know, you're coming off the alcohol and you created all these problems when you were drinking and stuff, and you got to work through them and stuff. And so usually they use that now. Of course, they've infiltrated the treatment places and stuff too. You know, they get everybody on drugs now to go to treatment. But back then, these problems were created, and you need to work through them and uncreate them and work through your problems and stuff and get over it. A drug wasn't going to solve anything.
Well, and especially
so, yeah,
if it's, you know, especially, let's say somebody has alcoholism, okay? And so how can another substance cure the an addiction to the first substance? Obviously, there's got to be a different way to do it, you know? But like you say, they've now infiltrated and they're monetizing these rehab centers. And, you know, one thing I get really sick of hearing, I'm sure it's true in a few cases, is this dual diagnosis thing. Well, I'm alcoholic, but I'm also blah, 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 blah. Well, yeah, that's what Big Pharma says, then hopes,
right.
You know. And how about just live your life and do your homework? I mean, you know, it's like we used to, counselors, like you said, you were a counselor, we used to tell you to work through it to, you know, but to a certain extent, bite the bullet, not to suffer unnecessarily, but to just be a realist. That life can be tough and hard, and it's, but the solution is not a pill, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And they've infiltrated, you know, the AA community and the treatment centers and stuff so bad that, you know, like I quit going about 10 years ago. I moved to Green Bay, and I was going to this meeting that I used to go when I lived here for years and years and years. And my God, it was like everybody was high. They come up, I mean, they're actually staggering from all the downs and stuff they put on them when they're in treatment, or the ADHD meds, if they're just talking mile a minute, like when I was a speed freak back in the 70s, you know, about nothing.
Yeah,
and,
it was.
And, you know, the old days we would have told them, you need to go home and get straight and come back when you're sober. But these are all pharmaceutical drugs now that the doctor said they need. So
no,
the same drugs messed us up that messed me back up in the 70s. You know, but I'm walking into an AA meeting and I'm expected to sit there and have people listen to me talking off the wall. I might as well be down in a Broadway bar talking to somebody.
You're exactly
so
right. And, you know, and it's so sad because that's the very premise. I mean, that's what Bill W., you know, over 70 years ago was fighting against, which is escapism, escaping, you know, the pain and work of being alive in this world. And I know exactly what you say. It's like every lights on, nobody home. There's so many people in these rooms now, in these 12-step meetings, that they're high. They're not even in the room, you know.
Yeah.
There was one guy that I saw who was leading a meeting, and he literally had some kind of morphine opiates in his pocket. He says, I take these all day long. You can't lead a meeting when you're an opiate addict, you know?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, really, some of these people are so high that years ago I would have told them, you need to go home and get sober and come back. You know, you're welcome back, but you need to be sober and straight. You know, just because it's shrinks and melt now. You know, I mean, and in the 70s when I was a speed freak, I had a quack doctor that gave me that speed. And gave me downers and gave me pain pills and everything.
Evelyn,
so I guess if I was in recovery, I should have been able to go to recovery meetings and say, I'm all right. The doctor gave it to me.
You remember some of these drugs? There was Preludin, a Dizoxin, and what were some of those? Oh, the White Cross and the Black Beauty, and they were speeds, you know. And the truck drivers took them, and the strippers took them, and you know, everybody took them. Okay. Well, now that like they're a medicine, that's my ADHD medicine, you know.
Right.
And it was like a street drug.
Yes, it was. And in the 70s, though, they finally pulled it back and said they couldn't prescribe speed. But now, then they came out with their ADHD and said it was needed. So now I say the U.S. speed freak's gone nuts here.
You know, you're really right about that. And you have to wonder, you know, how all this road rage has happened?
Uh-huh.
You know, we didn't used to have all this road rage, and you just have to wonder how many of these people, you know, are on these drugs. But you know, I can remember when I was younger, going to these docs and saying, well, I've got minimal brain dysfunction, and now, of course, it's ADHD, and I need Ritalin. You know, you write it down on a piece of paper. I heard about this drug, and it might help, you know. And then we were considered alcoholics or addicts, and now it's like, oh, I've got a mental illness.
Right. I need all these drugs. You know, but that's really sad for us that are really in recovery, that they've done this. You know, because, like I said, being an ex-addict and alcoholic, I haven't been there with all these drugs. I recognize them immediately, what drug people are on when they're talking and stuff. And so it's almost like remembering looking in the mirror. And it's like, I don't want to talk to these people. You know, I went there to talk about everyday problems and stuff, dealing with the disease and things, and I'm not going to sit there talking to somebody that's all screwed up on drugs, you know?
Who they're inebriated, right, they're dissipated, inebriated, and they're intoxicated and high, and they shouldn't be in a meeting. And like you say, you can tell right off the bat. Because it's a kind of like, there's a robot quality, there's a kind of like, it doesn't make me know, you know, it doesn't worry me quality. And one thing that, Speed used to do, you know, was it make you high and happy for no reason. So here's a bunch of people who are completely happy for no reason, you know?
Right. I mean, I was really glad when they quit selling it in the 70s because I don't think I could have ever got off it. Right, it made you high, you know, happy for no reason. I craved that so much and the energy that went with it that I don't think if they would have left it on the market with doctors giving it to me that I could have got off it. So this is what enraged me, too, when they started marketing it now. Because all of us ex-addicts and stuff, you know, pharma puts all those little screens on the line and stuff you can do and then take it to your doctor and tell them you got this and stuff. You know, the tempting it is for us ex-addicts to get back into that. Now it's legal, there won't be nothing wrong with it. The old message is in the head.
Yeah, and it's so sad that they've lost, the basic premise of the 12 steps was you do it with a higher power and with your group, with your community, and you don't do it through drugs. And you know, like Dr. Bob said, or maybe it was Dr. Bill, that we forfeited our right to chemical peace of mind, okay? And that is so basic to the 12 steps. And to show up at meetings when you haven't forfeited it, when you're totally high, you know, they're wrong. They don't know they're wrong because they're just taking the doctor's orders. And the doctors, it's like it lost a soul because there was nothing monetized. The 12 steps, and then here comes Big Pharma, and they're like, well, we can monetize this, you know?
Right. Well, do you know now that they're actually drugging alcoholics and addicts that go to treatment? Big Pharma came out with these drugs, and you got to stay on them for life, okay?
Oh.
I did an article a while back, and I went online to some of these forums and stuff, and there was people trying to get off these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get off them. And I got this comments from this one gal that she told me that was for drinking, and this drug that you had to take, she had to go to the doctor and get it once a month. So the doctor got his payment to go pick up this drug and stuff, and then she was going to try to go off it on her own, and so then she called him and told him, you know, she didn't need her drugs yet because she was trying to go off it on her own. And he said, well, you can't stay in the program if you don't come in for an appointment, and the appointment costs $100. Okay, $100 doesn't sound like so bad, but it's for the rest of your life and how many they hooked into this program to come every month to get these. And the FDA approved these drugs.
Do you know what the name is?
And the other one for... I wrote that article, but I don't remember. But the FDA approved them. You can go to their website, and they'll recommend them. And these treatment centers then push away from AA and stuff because they know that we don't approve this. And so they say, and if FDA does on its website, well, AA may be helpful. AA has been the cornerstone of sobriety for how many years? And it is the only thing that has worked over the years. So they can come out with whatever they want, but drugging alcoholics and addicts and keeping them dependent and then keeping the medical profession enriched and the pharmaceutical companies is destroying these people because their lives are not good on these drugs and this alcoholism drug. But the FDA promotes this.
Yeah, and the treatment centers have lost their soul because the whole it is the only thing that ever worked. And a big part of the reason it works is because it's social. And you know, the alcoholism and the drug addiction are diseases of isolation, and it forces you to, you know, to connect and bond with other people. But drugs are a completely isolated thing. So, you know, it's like, who needs a group when this drug, you know, doctor has you on this drug? It's amazing how they've infiltrated. There was some author that he wrote a book, and I interviewed him, and I don't remember the name or anything, but it was really very, very like, you might not be an alcoholic. Why don't you try this drug? It was very against the 12 steps and for the drug profiteering. And you know, the whole thing is so wrapped up with Wall Street, you know, because there was a time when Wall Street didn't dominate our lifestyles. It's like it wants you on drugs, you know, and so people are on drugs.
Right.
You know, I think the direct-to-consumer advertising. You just don't see it elsewhere, you know, and I don't think it's a coincidence that British Medical Journal is not in the U.S. It's in Britain, you know, to call out this stuff. Now, can you talk a little more, Evelyn, about the teen screen and you know, what you did and, you know, what you saw with that?
Oh, that was so horrible. And the government was behind that, too. Bush, you know, and it was a British journalist. I think it was in the that journal that the study was in that authors published this study about Bush, you know, wants us, the whole country, to be mentally ill, you know, setting up these screenings for everybody. But the kids was the worst because the kids, the questions that they asked, we got our hands on the questionnaire, and it was so bizarre because it addressed things that happen to kids every day. For instance, mm-hmm. Do you get nervous when you have to go stand up in front of a room and make a speech? Well, what teenager doesn't? You know, or do you sometimes think that other people are smarter or better looking than you?
Oh.
Well, for God's sakes, of course. You know, 100 times a day. You know, so I'm picturing these as a teen because I have a really good memory. And I'm picturing back if I was asked these. And it was like, you would have to lie to pass that test because these, you would have had those thoughts because they're perfectly normal thoughts for teenagers and kids. And so you'd have had to answer yes to everyone. Well, then you had a mental disorder, okay? So even if you lied, the next time you had that thought, which I said some of them 100 times a day in some cases,
mm-hmm.
You'd think, oh, my God, they said I'm mentally ill if I had that thought.
Yeah.
You know, you talk these little kids into thinking they're mentally ill. And then they started out, they weren't even telling the parents that they were giving these.
Wow.
What they would do with this passive consent, the kids were supposed to bring home this letter, and if the parents didn't want them to have this screening, they should sign it and send it back. Well, the kids that didn't get it sent back got to take the test. Okay? Well, you know, kids don't bring stuff home half the time. And plus, they were using these ploys to bribe these kids to get them to take the test, and we got information on their notes and all this stuff, and it showed them that they knew that parents probably wouldn't approve, but if they could talk the kids into it, they could talk the parents into it. So they'd give them, if they brought the letters back and stuff, they'd give them pizza coupons or movie coupons and stuff like this. I mean, you know, they made it so they talked these kids into it. They conned them into taking these, you know. And I went up fighting against them, you know, and I just went all out against them because that's all they were. Was pushers, and then that was the time too that Bush was bringing in all these in states for drugs to be approved by Medicaid. Okay, so in conjunction with these screening programs, he was getting these approved to be covered by Medicaid and stuff, and so on Medicare, so that people could get these drugs free while us taxpayers paid for them. So again, it's going to be all on our taxpayers' dime, drugging these kids. You know, and I think they finally did get that stuck in there somewhere, stuck in some bill. That they probably screen kids in schools now.
Well,
too, they had screenings, too, for elderly and stuff, too, because of this proving these drugs. So then they had, you know, the elderly are probably pretty depressed. We should screen all them in nursing homes and stuff. You know, it was so sick.
You know, almost just always a screening program is a big pharma front, you know, because... Who's paying for it? I mean, the government isn't screening, you know. I mean, it's just so unethical, because it looks like, oh, we just care about you. We're trying to help you. No, you're not. You know, and it works. And I know so many people who've said to me in the last few years, you know, I'm bipolar. I have a general anxiety disorder. I have major depression disorder, because somebody screened and told them that. And like you say, you know, are you afraid to talk in front of your classmates? You know, just a like pathologizing normal stuff. It's just
right.
Sickening to me, because it shows that people are really dumb, too. I mean, how dumb are people to not see, you know, like we all know when somebody calls on the phone and tries to sell you something, we all know it. But don't people know that the screening is just, you know?
Absolutely. And then, like with that teen screen, there was questions on there if they're upset or something, and yes or no. So if they were, it didn't say, well, did anything happen to you in the last few days? You know, did you do bad in a football game, or did make the cheerleading squad, or break up with a boyfriend or something? Don't ask you nothing about that. It's just, oh, yeah, they have that. You know, that, like you said before, it's situation, especially with kids. My God, so many things go on. That they could probably explain away any negative feeling if they were given the chance of what led to that.
It's just growing up. You know, here in Evanston, where I live, we have Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was one or two suicides over the last few years, which, you know, happens, okay? It happens at college, you know, young adults. It happens, you know, in the world. But within just hours, NAMI descended upon the town and met with
right.
the university officials. And, you know, we have to... There's not enough access, and there's barriers to treatment. In other words, we're going to use this as an opportunity to sell SSRIs, which probably were behind these suicides. We'll never know that, you know. But you know,
right.
I get when I hear stigma and barriers and barriers to treatment, I hear pharma, because that's their language. There's no
right.
stigma. The stigma is being mentally healthy and dealing with your issues and not taking drugs. You know, they've made this so-called mental illness cool. They have, when you go up on Pinterest and you look under mental illness, you'll see all these posters they've made for like 12-year-olds and 14-year-olds telling them how cool it is to quote-unquote have a mental illness, you know. And then the idea of barriers to treatment, meaning that we're not selling enough drugs. There's no barriers to treatment. Everywhere you go, GPs or specialists, they'll put you on these drugs.
That's what I saw.
You know, the barrier to treatment is such a lie. You know, in the military, they talked about stigma. No, they had one drug increased 700% in the military. There's no stigma to the mental illness, but
absolutely
that's Big Pharma talking.
Well, Big Pharma has bought all them off, too. You know, I wrote years ago about that, all the areas that it's bought off, and in the military, it would, you know, pay for trips for pharmacists and things, go on nice trips and take them out to dinner and all this kind of stuff, and got them on their payroll, and then they start prescribing all the drugs they want them to, you know. And like you talk about those front groups, you know, pharma-funded front groups,
mm-hmm,
like NAMI
mm-hmm.
and Mental Health America, and then when a new drug comes out, then they'll come out with a new front group, like the childhood bipolar one, you know, and pharma funds them all. And those get investigated, and we find this out. Senator Grassley investigated them back starting in 2009. It all came out that, yes, three-quarters or something of their funding comes from that, and they don't do nothing about it. They're doing it today. They get just as much money from pharma as they ever did. Once they were exposed, didn't matter. It's going
no,
on.
No, you're right. And you know, the ultimate example is this Robert Califf, you know, who's going to be the new FDA commissioner. And he is basically a pharma operative. I mean, he unabashedly works for Big Pharma. And for, I think he had 23 drug companies that fund him. Okay, so...
Yeah.
You know, he is the first one to say it's great that the government and pharma collaborate. And you know, there's no conflict there because we're on the same team. So it shows, and he will be, I'm sure, approved as the next commissioner. So it really shows that nothing gets done. Nobody cares. It's right out there. This guy is working for Big Pharma, not for the government, and he's going to be the next commissioner. So nobody gives a darn. It's not even hidden disclosures.
No, anymore it isn't. They don't care. The revolving door, they go in and out, and, you know, and in Congress, too. You know, they go in and out and work for the same people that lobbied them while they were, you know, in Congress, and maybe later they'll come back and work, or you know, lobbyists will come back and work for a congressman or something again. And they don't even hide it anymore.
No, there's no hiding it. And getting, you know, and getting back to Grassley and those exposures there, you know, one of the ironies is that these front groups, you know, with the professional patients who are going to cry at the open mic, they get everyone on drugs, but the truth is we pay for it. We, the taxpayers, because they not only get everyone on drugs, they make sure that their entitlement program drugs, like you said, with the children, getting them. So it's like, even if you don't care about, you know, so much of the nation turning into zombies, you should care about your own tax dollars, you know?
Right. Yeah, those were all the things that enraged me, that I was so angry about them drugging these kids and stuff, but that they're forcing me to pay for it. You know, I don't get it.
You know, remember this, you and I once wrote a piece together about the price of these drugs, you know, and it was just thousands and thousands a year. I mean, to have a child who was, quote-unquote, mentally ill, it was just thousands. And I think one, you know how they had a campaign recently, they love add-on drugs, because, you know, if you add a drug onto the first one, you know, the idea is that maybe the first one isn't working, but you'd rather add a second one on, so they're going to double their money, you know?
Right.
And they had this Abilify, which was so heavily advertised, and it was over $1,000 a month. That is more than most people's rent or mortgage payment. And who pays, you know?
We did.
I mean, just astounding how they say, well, you know, is your antidepressant not working? Well, then add this on. Well, maybe, just maybe, you don't have depression. Maybe you have, like, a bad job, a bad marriage, bad housing, bad health care, you know?
Exactly. Well, yeah, a while back I talk about this all the time because I did a prescribing guidelines for bipolar in little children. Okay, this was so disgusting. I mean, when I first got that study, I just got sick reading it. These were for toddlers, okay? Well, they went down the line, and they kept adding things on, okay? This didn't work. Well, after this much time and stuff, then add this. And it was all the antidepressants, the mood stabilizers, which are really epilepsy drugs.
Right.
The downers, you know, Librium and Ativan and all those, and then the antipsychotics. So I got down, if you took a kid that didn't respond, like they said, to all these steps, you got to the end, you added all those drugs on, and I went and figured out the cost on drugstore.com of each drug, and figured out this one kid would have spent $48,000 a year on drugs, not the shrink's visit, nothing like that, just the drugs, $48,000 a year for a bipolar kid. And I said, what other field of medicine would a parent be conned into spending $50,000 a year on drugs for a disorder that couldn't even be verified and documented in any way? That's what they put out, these guidelines, these paid shrinks by the pharmaceutical industry. Put those out for little kids. This is how insane it has gotten. And I think you and I talked about this before. It was years ago that I found in the Medicaid records going through to see who they were prescribing these drugs for, that there was 23 infants in Florida under the age of a year that were prescribed antipsychotics. Well, I reported that big time, and Grassley looked into that, and of course, then it was like the next year they didn't have any under age one, okay? Now, wasn't it you that told me that how many young kids now, toddlers and stuff, are on these antipsychotics?
Yeah, well,
maybe
yeah.
Wasn't, but it seems to me
was, you know, how can a child, I mean, by definition, a child has all these emotional things because they're children. I mean, how could a child even have a mental illness? That is the ultimate, you know, unethical behavior of Big Pharma, because you're really going to ruin this child's life. I mean, this child's
absolutely
not going to get to develop normally. And there's pathologizing somebody's newborn baby. You remember David Healy, you know, the... And he talked about, because I used to... know him pretty well, and we do interviews, and he said that there were actually doctors who would diagnose to a pregnant lady that your fetus is not even born yet is bipolar.
Oh my. You know, I think I read something like that years ago. Yeah, I think I did. Yeah.
I mean, it's to stoop that low, but I don't just blame Big Pharma. I blame lawmakers. I blame the American people to be that gullible. or that easily sold? You know, what if I were, I don't have children, but if I had a child and they tried to tell me that, at the minimum, I'd go for a second opinion. You know, at the minimum, I'd say,
well,
you know, I was told this, you know.
Well, somebody asked me one time, well, how do they talk these parents into this? But this has been several years ago now. And
right.
I said, well, easy. They bring them in and they sit the little kid down and they say, oh, your poor little kid here has this. You know, it's too bad, but we do have these drugs that can help it, so we can do this. You don't tell him that he did the same thing to 10 other parents that day. Making these parents think this kid is special, you know. They don't tell him this is assembly line and we did the same thing to 10 other kids today. You know, and Pharma's got all them doctors on the payroll, all the shrinks.
Oh, they are. And you know,
the
sad thing is that some of these parents really get into the idea of their kid needs these. And you know, you'd think the parents would get together and they'd say, look, they told me this, they told you this, maybe they're profiteering at our expense. But instead, these parents have, like, chat rooms where they'll say, well, we've tried him on the mood stabilizer, well, we're going to add a little ad of it. And they really get into you know, being pawns of Pharma, just like Pharma wanted, you know. And they never realize they're only treating side effects because the kid was okay to begin with. But now the kid is probably never going to get off the drugs because of all the side effects of trying to come off them, you know.
Well, certainly, certainly. I mean, that's how they... The pharma, you know, I made this timeline of the path to child drugging in this country. And if you follow it along, you will see when they came out, they had a little bit of ADHD. They called it something else in the early on, you know, that they were given speed for. But it wasn't real high priced then and stuff either, you know. And
right.
Then they moved up, and they got the SSRI antidepressants, and they wanted to put kids on those. Well, they already had them on speed because they, you know, for the ADHD.
Right.
And so then they said, well, these kids get depressed. You know, we think they have depression. Well, yeah, they had depression. You crash off speed. I can tell you that. Yes, I can't
right,
sleep
right.
That. You know, I'll lay there and just get over it for a couple days. You know, and so, you know, that happens. So this played right into them when the SSRIs came out.
Oh,
so then they put
God.
Them on both. And then they came out with those mood stabilizers. Well, these kids were actually kind of nervous and stuff, too. You know, so they switched those epilepsy drugs into mood stabilizers. David Healy wrote a lot on this. And so then they started adding that to it. Then the antipsychotics are coming out, the first one in 93.
Right.
So then, that's when they broke in. All these symptoms indicated they were bipolar. So give them the
right.
antipsychotics. So there was childhood bipolar disorder. They invented it right up the line. And then they had them front groups promoting it all. But this is what it was. And so that's how they invented bipolar for children.
Yeah, yeah, you really covered it, and you could see it happening. I mean, it wasn't, you know, hard to miss if you were looking for it, how they were changing the dialogue, changing diagnostics, of course, paying doctors, but just what a sickness to pathologize childhood like they've done. You know, when I was growing up, it would be unthinkable to put a kid on a psychoactive drug.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
It wouldn't enter anybody's mind to do that. You know?
I mean, it was just... But like you said, then now that they have the childhood bipolar or the... And there's all the ones that Biederman invented, like oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder and
yeah.
mood disorders. And how about they're growing up, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, then they never talk about home circumstances and stuff, what might be going on at home causing kids to act like this, possibly, if there's alcoholism.
Right.
I used to say the definition of codependency was any condition in the home that caused for the children's emotional needs didn't get met. And I would name off hundreds of things. Like if you had tons of kids, you both had to work, you know, there's not enough time to
right.
tend to each
right.
child and things. If you had a
or there's not enough
family
money
members
and
all the attention had to go on that, you know, there wasn't enough emotions to go around for all the kids. Or if it was alcoholism or drug addiction, well, those are obvious problems. But they never look at that when they give these little checks and stuff, little lists of behaviors and stuff. What's going on in this child's life that they're acting like this?
You know, at
University
of Illinois at Chicago, here in Chicago where I am, they established a pediatric mood disorder clinic or institute. So, you know, assuming it's so prevalent that you need a clinic for it, okay? You know,
right.
it, And it's and of course now we need customers. But the woman doctor that set it up was completely pharma funded, and pharma just probably said, "Well, look, we can have a little pill mill here, you know, like Biederman did with at Harvard. It's just a pill mill."
Yeah.
And, you know, again, though, when we're talking about this, that is so obvious to us as reporters, you just wonder, like, why nothing is done and why they get away with it and why it continues. Because it is pretty obvious. There's so much to back it up. Like the article we're talking about in BMJ is a case in point. It's very obvious that we were misled as a public, you know?
Right. So we're ripped off for all the money. The children are damaged so much. All these murders and suicides and everything. And they get off scot-free for doing this, hiding all this. I want to tell you an interesting point that I say. Years ago, this Joan Luby, this quack on the pharma payroll, was coming up with how little kids were bipolar. Very little kids, you know, 2 and 3 and stuff. One of her points was she had a case where the child was inappropriately touching the mother and coming on sexually to the mother, and immediately my mind was going, I always go back to the learned behavior and stuff, you know. Where would a little child even think of this, learn to do this?
Oh,
and bingo,
my goodness.
Look at the TV. You know, the filth on these TVs.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
You know, I mean, mothers used to always, well, in my day, I didn't watch soap operas, but my friends did. They just propped a little one up there and sit in a little chair to watch this and stuff. Well, you see it every day on TV. All these bizarre sex acts and stuff like that. In fact, my daughter just said her soap opera's now so dirty she don't let her 10-year-old son watch it. But you see them having sexual acts of all this kind. This is what the kid learned from staring at the TV. He didn't come up with this. He's going up to his mother and trying to pull up her blouse and stuff. That's what he observed. But she's trying to make it as a sign of bipolar disorder in a little 3-4-year-old kid. How bizarre. This is the insanity of it all.
Yeah,
you know,
I was on some progressive website, you know, which is we're supposed to care about, like human rights and you know stuff that you and I are talking about now, and there was some extremely racy, sexual, almost pornographic image that was selling something, and I thought, what the heck? I mean, at what point do we say money's more important than our values? You know?
Exactly.
And it was just such a shock. It was like, what is this doing on a progressive website? And now, I've told you before, I don't keep a TV. You can watch some things like the Super Bowl or whatever on your laptop, but I don't really watch the TV, so I'm not aware of that, but I totally know you're telling me the truth. And it's
absolutely.
Like...
Uh-oh. We're getting cut off already again, Martha.
All right.
It's so fun having you on because you know everything about this, and I want to have you on again soon.
Well,
because
thank
I don't
you
know
for
any
your...
other journalist or author that knows everything you do. Okay?
Thank you, Evelyn, and I appreciate all your work, and great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Appreciate you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and I hope you learned something today. And if you can, don't get your kids off drugs if they're on them. Please. Okay. Tune in again next week. We'll see you then. Bye.